This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. We're talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and our guest is Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled, now in its 18th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet on the Opera Grounds. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Desiree.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
So we're talking today, this is the last of our opera series. It's such a pleasure to do this with you every year. We're talking about the opera Vanessa by Samuel Barber. And this is a very, I almost felt like I was watching a film, like reading your chapter in the book, like I was watching film noir.
It is. It's sort of based in that period, 1930s. It has that sort of mysterious overlay. And the composer and librettist loved the work of Isaac Dinesen and her seven Gothic tales and based the feeling of the opera on that. The costume designer actually called it a mood. The whole set and design was one of moody elegance, which is what you'll find in this piece. But there's a lot going on in this opera, a lot to think about. And it is by Samuel Barber. Everybody knows Samuel Barber, though they may not realize it. He is the extraordinary composer who composed Adagio for strings, which is one of the saddest, most melancholic, beautiful pieces of music on earth, played at all funerals.
And it's true.
It is. It's a very beautiful piece. And that's your best frame of reference, because Samuel Barber didn't write many operas. This was a big success, Vanessa. His following opera, Antony and Cleopatra, based on Shakespeare, was not. He was mainly an orchestral composer and wrote songs. But Vanessa was something that was close to his heart for many reasons. He had hoped to write an opera for many years, but he felt that it was something he really needed to be familiar with the art form. So he went to operas all over the place. And then there was the issue of who would he work with. And there were a number of famous writers, James Aggie, Thornton Wilder, Tennessee Williams even. He considered writing a piece on Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. And none of that came to anything. So he thought then that, well, maybe he would ask Giancarlo Menotti, which was an interesting choice because he and Giancarlo were partners. They had met in the 20s in the Curtis School of Music in Philadelphia, where they had both been students. They both became very famous composers. Menotti wrote many, many operas. His Amelia Goes to the Ball was premiered at the Met long before this opera happened. And the two had a wonderfully colorful life. They were in love at a time where it was not appropriate for two men to be in love. They lived in Europe, and they lived the good life amidst a world of artists and writers, and were wildly happy, really. But when the war came, they came
and accepted
Within that community, because still, again, you know, we're talking years when homosexuality was illegal, technically. They came back to Westchester, where they bought a very beautiful home and became a sort of a center for artists and writers. And this was a happy time in their lives. And I find so ironic in 1928, when, let me see if I have those dates right, when he was still a young man, he wrote the Adagio for strings at the height of their happiness, which seems so strange that he should write this work of extreme sadness at a very happy time in their lives.
You know, the world of art is full of those kinds of ironies. There's a lot of really dark, for example, films that came out of economically prosperous times, and a lot of really light fantasy films that came out of the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is part of this whole sort of scenario. As time went on, the first glow of the relationship perhaps went off a little bit because they were very different. Samuel Barber was rather reserved, came from a New England background, was a Protestant, and wasn't outgoing. going, whereas Giancarlo Monatti was all Italian. He was very flamboyant and had loved to party, and the house was always full of people and noise, and Barbara wasn't always happy with this. And what ultimately happened was that Giancarlo strayed and had a number of relationships, and they did ultimately split up, which broke Barbara's heart. This man was a melancholic from birth, it seems. From a very early age, he was reared in a musical family, but this melancholia followed him through life. And it's, to me, I find fascinating, and I did a little reading on this, the difference between melancholia and depression. Are the two one and the same? Did we used to call it melancholia, and now it's depression? It's not quite that simple, because apparently for the melancholic, you can pull out of it. So when he was composing, he was happy.
Maybe you can pull out of it by writing adagio for strings.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that was his therapy. Whereas a depressive can't always pull out of it. Once you're in that dark trough, it's not so easy to come out. So they went their separate ways, but it broke Barbara's heart, I must say. They sold the level home in Westchester, and he considered himself homeless after that. Monatti lived in Scotland with a younger man, and the whole thing then came to an end when Barbara died at the age of 71, but he died in Giancarlo's arms. Giancarlo was with him when he died. Then Giancarlo lived on, died at 92 or 93, just a couple of years ago. So we're talking contemporary here.
Yeah.
We're also talking about a composer who did not he was not a sort of a follow-on, belonged to cliques or styles of music. He did not buy into the atonal, dissonant music of the period, which everybody else was doing. He loved lyricism, and he wanted to entertain his audiences, so which made him a little old-fashioned in a way, but he didn't mind. I mean, this is the way he composed. The interesting thing, which we'll talk about after we've been through the story of Vanessa, is where are Giancarlo Monatti and Samuel Barber in this opera? Which characters do they represent? Because they are writing about themselves. It's very clear as one goes through the story as to where that those allegiances lie.
It's such a great story.
I
was really drawn into it.
It is. When Metropolis, the great conductor, did the premiere performances at the Metropolitan Opera, he said, at last we have a great American grand opera.
Yeah.
He was not exactly right, because it was not about an American subject. It was written by an American composer. But as Barber himself said, he says, if the theme is great, where does it matter where it is? You can set it anywhere. So it was set... It was designed to be presented in a Nordic country, a northern country, and clearly one in Europe. So Scandinavia is where one usually sets this. It's a beautiful house, a mansion set in its own parklands in the middle of winter, where the sun never shines. It's always dark, it's always dreary, it's always depressing. That's the set that we are faced with. And in this production, yes, it could be Scandinavia in the middle of winter with the short days. When the opera opens, we find we're in the great drawing room. The whole opera takes place in this beautiful mansion. And there are three women, Vanessa, who is the name character, of course, who stands by the fireplace, her mother, the Baroness, who says very little, and Erica, who is her niece. Erica actually describes herself more as Vanessa's shadow, which is what she is. And already the mysteriousness is apparent when we learn that Vanessa has been waiting for 20 years for the return of her lover, Anatole.
And we don't know exactly what the circumstances are of his disappearance and his reappearance, but we know that as the curtain rises, well, of course, there's no curtain here, but anyway, as the action begins... Mm-hmm. She's sitting there waiting, reading Oedipus Rex?
Yes. Monatti and Barbara had a lot of little in references to their own lifestyle. The opulent lifestyle that Barbara was reared in and raised is the type of lifestyle of the opera. The food, the very beginning, Erica is ordering dinner, and the foods that are in that menu were his special foods. There's a Protestant hymn at one point that he loves. So these are sort of little insides that were meant something to the composer. composer and the librettist that the rest of us learn about.
But also, I mean, there is loosely some thematic similarities, as we will see, between Oedipus Rex and what happens in the
Yes, that's
plot.
Right. Yeah, apparently in the house they owned in Westchester, they often would read the classics to one another. That's the origin of that little piece of plot that seems so extraneous but does fit in perfectly with what happens. The house is dark and sort of in shadow because the curtains, the windows have all been covered, the mirrors are covered. The great portrait of Vanessa when she was in her 20s, a young woman when she was in love with Anatole, has been covered. Everything is covered. Time has stood still. Vanessa won't face the fact that 20 years have passed. She wants to be as beautiful as she was then. And she's trying to do the impossible. But now she has learned that he's coming back. So when the opera opens, we have the scene between Vanessa and Erica, her niece, in preparation for Anatole's return. Vanessa is anxious. She's striding up and down. The Baroness leaves and goes to her room. And Erica sings, as they're waiting, a very beautiful aria called Must Winter Come So Soon. She's looking out of the window and she sees the snow. I think if people want a frame of reference for this set, you should think a sort of Chekhov. There's a lot of Chekhovian, especially at the end, the farewell scene is straight Chekhov. They love Chekhov, these two men.
Yeah, why does the whole thing feel kind of Russian?
Yeah, well, that's the sort of the frame of reference that they are taking. You could also think Dr. Zhivago and other, you know, sleigh bells in the snow. They wait for Anatole's return with the horse and the sleigh and the bells ringing. In fact, Vanessa says, tell the gatekeeper to the park to keep the bell ringing so that he won't miss the entrance in the snow. So as they're waiting, Erica sings this beautiful aria, which has been excerpted by every singer doing an audition because it's often taken out and just sung as an audition piece. But here she sings, must the winter come so soon? Night after night I hear the hungry deer wandering, weeping in the woods. And from his house of brittle bark hoots the frozen owl. Must the winter come so soon? Here in this forest neither dawn nor sunset marks the passing of the days.
Must the winter come?
And that is the niece, Erica, who you kind of have to feel a little sorry for because here she is living in this house. It reminds me a little bit of Dickens' Great Expectations, mm-hmm. where Miss Havisham is still in her wedding dress having been jilted at the altar decades earlier.
Yes, well, wait till you hear what happens. The opera is between Vanessa and Erica, really. Anatole is a sort of a side issue, as it turns out. So she sings the aria, then leaves the stage. Vanessa says, "I will greet him alone." And she sits with her back to the door, and in the doorway, then there's a silhouette of the man who has arrived in a fur coat, but you can't see who he is. And in our production, I think it'll be very effective. There is upstage, the back of the across the windows, there's this great mirror that had been covered, and it's cracked. So everything in the reflection is distorted with all that implies. And as the action starts, this great mirror moves sideways, revealing the snow outside and completely barren birch trees. It's rather like an abstract painting. It's a beautiful set. Anyway, he appears in the doorway and she sings an aria, but she doesn't turn or go to him. She just sings. She says, "Anatole, if you still love me, then this is wonderful. If you do not, you must leave at once." So she explains.
Sending him back out into the snow.
Of course, yeah. She's waited 20 years and she wants to know that this is going to be okay. She turns to face the man and shrieks because it is not Anatole. The man standing in the doorway is a stranger. And Erica comes running in and she helps her aunt out of the room and goes back and says to the man, "Who are you? What are you doing here? You must leave." And he says, "I am Anatole. I am the son of Anatole. My father died, the man that Vanessa had loved." So Erica is completely taken aback by this. But this man seems quite at home in the house. I mean, he has heard the story of Vanessa. His father is dead. He has come now to seek who knows what. It will be revealed. He picks up the wine that's on the table and recognizes his father's favorite wine. And then he takes Erica's hand and he turns to her and says, "Join me for dinner." She said, "Well, it's not really for me." He said, "That's all right. Join me for dinner." And there's a very intimate moment here where the two, the son of the father, Anatole, and Erica sit down to dinner as that first scene ends. So as the opera progresses then, the next scene is a little while later when they are all gathered together. It turns out that Vanessa has decided to cut her losses, if you like, and she has accepted the son of the man she loved as her lover. She has now transferred her affections to the younger man, to Anatole, believing that she loves him. And she's wildly happy. She's ecstatically happy. And they party together. They go skating together. And soon there will be an engagement. Before that happens, though, we meet some of the other characters in the house. The doctor, the family doctor, who clearly brought Vanessa into the world. He's been with the family all that time. And how happy he is that the house is now coming to life again. And in this little group setting, he invites Vanessa to dance. And they sing a wonderful folk tune here, a little Under the Willow Tree, that he and Vanessa dance to, and everybody else sits around and sort of is amused. And then he gets Anatole up, and Anatole has two left feet, but they dance. Let's hear, this is one of the lighter moments of this opera, Under the Willow Tree.
Under the willow tree, two doves cry, under the willow tree. Two doves cry, oh, where shall we sleep, my love? Whither shall we fly? Where shall we sleep, my love? Whither shall we fly? The wood has swallowed the moon, the fog has swallowed the shore, the green toad has swallowed the key to my door.
Ah, charming, charming! I wish I could compete with you, doctor.
Nonsense, young man! Give me your hand, and I'll show you the stairs. Right first, back, then left, forward, slide. One, two, three, reverse, two, three.
Under the willow tree,
two, three,
where shall we sleep, my love?
that's one of the little dance waltz sequences from the middle of Vanessa. Things get then a little more serious. Erica goes to the Baroness and explains that she had spent one night with Anatole. That first night after the dinner party when the curtain falls and we don't know what happens, she had spent the night with him, but only that one night. The Baroness is appalled. The Baroness has not spoken to Vanessa for 20 years. She was so disgusted at her choice of deciding to shut herself off life that she didn't speak to her.
This is her own daughter.
This is her own daughter.
So mother and daughter living in the same house, mm-hmm. not speaking. The niece, Erica, like I said, poor Erica.
Yeah, right.
The mirror's covered. It's crazy.
It's bizarre.
It's really
bizarre. They've sealed themselves off from the world. And the true relationship here, the love relation perhaps, is between Vanessa and her niece. They're very close because they spend all this time together.
They're the only people who talk to each other.
That's right, yeah. Everything else is sort of shut off. And it's an unnatural life for the young Erica, of course. At this point, though, Erica tells the Baroness what happened, that there was one night that she has spent. And the Baroness turns to her and said, well, is he going to do the right thing? And at that point, Anatole comes in on his own, and Erica confronts him. What is going to happen? And he says, yes, he would have married. He would marry her, but will she accept his offer? And he sings here, this is his point of view. He sings to her, outside the house, the world has changed. Life is swifter than before. There is no time for idle gestures. I cannot offer you eternal love, for we have learned today that such words are lies. But the brief passion of pleasure of passion, yes, sweet, long friendship. Who can resist your gentle beauty, Erica? How happy we would be together. The velvet rooms for jeweled suppers, the coast of Spain, gilded grand hotels, glass marble stations for goodbyes. This we could share together if you accept my love. And who knows, my love might last forever, Erica. So that's where he's coming from. He has come. He's on the make. The Baroness calls him a thief. He has come and he will marry whichever of the two women will have him. And in this situation, because he's been put on the spot by the Baroness and Erica, he explains to her, yes, I will love you now, but not maybe forever. And Erica won't have this. She now in turn says, no, she will not take him. She says to the Baroness, she says, he can have Vanessa. She waited so long. I want true love, real love, love that will last. So let's hear some of his aria. Beforehand, I should perhaps preface this with the recording I'm using today. It's a beautiful one on Chandos with Susan Graham is singing Erica early on in her career. Christine Brewer sings Vanessa. Anatole is William Burden, who sings here many times, and Leonard Slatkin, the famous conductor, will be conducting. As a little aside here, too, I should mention from the last cut, the doctor plays this wonderful role throughout. He's the mainstay of the family. And in our production, the doctor is going to be sung by James Morris. James Morris is the Wotan of our time. He is an extraordinarily wonderful Wagnerian singer. He's not now singing the great roles. He was here many, many years ago. He sang our one and only Flying Dutchman even before I came to Santa Fe. And he sings the cameo role of the Doctor, which is something, a special treat for this 60th anniversary, something to look forward to. But now we'll hear William Burden singing his philosophy of love and life to Erica.
Can resist your gentle beauty, Erica? How happy we could be together. Of Spain for solitude, the gilded grand hotels for dancing, the glass and marble stations for
that was Anatole singing of his lukewarm love.
Yes, absolutely. In a way, I think Anatole is Menotti. You know, he loves where he will, as he will. In fact, this opera is a thesis on the subject of love. Let me read to you what Menotti said in the preface to the vocal score in 1964, because I think it sort of sums up what this opera is all about. He said, "Love only exists as a compromise." Think about this. I mean, we can think of our own personal situations in these lines. "Whomever we love, it's not the image of the person we expected. This story is one of two women, Vanessa and Erica, caught in the central dilemma which faces every human being, whether to fight for one's ideals to the point of shutting oneself off from reality or compromise with what life has to offer, even lying to oneself for the mere sake of living. So do you take the risk? Do you hope that things are going to work out? Or do you hold out and hope that you'll find the one true eternal love that does seem to be elusive in literature and life, music, all of that?"
Right, right.
So then we get to the big party scene. The house is going to be open. There's going to be a fabulous ball. There's going to be an announcement of the engagement of Vanessa to Anatole. The doctor opens this scene. He's a little tipsy. He said, "I should have been a poet and not a doctor, and I have to sober up in order to make the announcement." Vanessa comes running in and she says, "Oh, doctor, that neither the Baroness nor Erica will come down for the announcement." So he says, "Don't worry, I'll go upstairs and make sure everything's fine." He goes up, comes back and says, "It's going to be all right. They will be here." So everybody goes into the ballroom for the announcement. And as soon as that happens and the great drawing room is left empty, Erica appears at the top of the stairs. She's obviously very ill and in pain, and she comes down and she collapses, sobbing, Anatole. She makes her way to the door of the house and opens it, and there's, of course, a freezing, icy night storm outside, and she goes out. The Baroness has seen her go and raises the alarm and says, quick, someone has to go find her. They thought she had gone to the lake to kill herself. Anatole leads the pack. Of course, they go out, and sometime later he returns with Erica in his arms. She is near death. Her dress is covered in blood. And they take her to her bedroom, put her to bed, and the doctor says, "Leave us alone. I will tend her." And as soon as Vanessa and Anatole are together, Vanessa wants to know what's happened. She confronts him. Does Erica love you? And he denies it. He said, "No, that she doesn't." But he explains...
Which is true.
She had rejected him. And he sings, "Love has a bitter core." It's those same lines I just read you of Menotti's. Love is not all sweetness and light, and we must prepare for the bad times as well as the good times. And even though he will take Vanessa away and they'll have the marvelous times, it won't always be easy. So he sings, "Love has a bitter core." Let's hear a little of that.
Oh,
We're listening to music from the opera Vanessa by Samuel Barber, talking to Desiree Mays. It's our annual opera series, and the plot thickens.
It does. So we're getting towards the end now. I think now we have a sense that Anatole doesn't truly love. Vanessa knows it is not the man that she waited for, but she is prepared to take a risk and to leave with this younger man for the short amount of happiness they may have together. We all know, I think, it's not going to last, but she wants to go, whereas Erica is left recovering. Erica tells the Baroness that she had been pregnant. And when she went out that night into the storm, her last words were, "His child will not be born." She goes out deliberately to lose the child, which of course she does. She tells this to the Baroness, who says nothing, simply gets up and leaves the room. She now will not speak to Erica either.
So she's really not talking to anybody. And so Erica has made herself miscarry. And Vanessa knows everything?
Vanessa doesn't know. Vanessa lives in this blind haze of hope and not wanting to know. She's suspicious. She comes to Erica on the day they're leaving. The final scene is where Anatole and Vanessa leave to go to Paris. And she comes to Erica. She loves Erica. They're very close. She tells her that she has left her the estate, that Anatole doesn't know about this. Erica says, I'll stay. I'll stay and I will take care of the Baroness. And Vanessa then asks her point blank, was it Anatole? Were you in love with Anatole? And she hedges. She doesn't tell her the truth. She says, I thought I was in love with someone who didn't love me. So Vanessa chooses again to be blind to the reality of what really did happen, and she chooses to accept that. So this brings us to the final, I think, the great heart of the opera, where they all collect together in the beautiful drawing room before Vanessa and Anatole leave. This is very Russian. It's also in Chekhov that the last scene of the cherry orchard is where the family get together, and for one last time they bid one another farewell before they go their separate ways. So again, that whole philosophy is in this quintet. It's sung as a canon where one singer comes in after the other and each is expressing their own sense of sadness as they leave. Vanessa starts, to leave, to break, to find, to keep, to stay, to wait, to dream, to hope, to weep and remember. To love is all of this, and none of this is love. The light is not the sun, nor the tide the moon. So let's hear as much as we can of the great quintet.
Thank you.
have come pretty much to the end of the opera.
Yes, yes. It's a sad piece. It's a mysterious, sad, melancholic piece. But sometimes, you know, it's wonderful to sort of revel in that. There's something very beautiful about this music. As Vanessa and Anatole leave, the servants are in tears and they go, and Erica is finally left alone. And she closes the drapes. The shattered mirror comes back in. She is now going to take up the role that Vanessa had for 20 years. But there will be no Anatole for Erica. And it's a sad ending.
Right. And we hope that she gets back on speaking terms with the Baroness eventually.
Yeah, but there's no guarantee.
And there's no guarantee of that. And I mean, as you wrote about in Opera Unveiled, the set is sort of a pearl gray.
It's a pearl gray, yes. Yeah.
Dusty. I sort of
snowy,
think of it as
cold.
Plum and gray and cold. Uh-huh. And there she is, left alone, the end. But it is mysterious because, of course, you never know what new person is going to come into your life if you're Erica and the Baroness dies and you have this estate. You'll be sort
and actually,
of,
I think Vanessa might come back. It's not going to last, obviously, with Anatole. Well, there could be a part two.
There could, yeah, right. Vanessa two.
Vanessa returns.
But, I mean, it's mysterious because she will Erica will actually be an eligible bachelorette and Vanessa might or might not come back. She might end up having great fun with the son of her true love.
Yeah, but when
you can only imagine and talk about it as you're leaving the parking lot of the opera.
That's right, exactly. But when the curtains close and the light fades and that's it, and the moon is out and you make your way back to the car, you actually just think about the music. You carry that with you. It's beautiful. And it is the adagio for strings that sort of permeates the piece. So it was interesting how this came into being, actually. Rudolf Bing, who was the great general director of the Metropolitan Opera, knew of Barber's music and asked for an opera, commissioned it, and this was the one that he got. But when he heard it, apparently Samuel Barber went to the offices at the old opera house, and he played and sang the entire opera to Rudolf Bing.
What?
Everything except the quintet. He couldn't do that. It wasn't quite finished, and he didn't do that.
It's hard to sing a quintet, too.
Yeah, exactly. So, but Bing was blown away, and he said he would produce this, and the opera was produced. The first choice for Vanessa was an interesting choice. It was Maria Callas. So Menotti and Barber invited Maria Callas to their home in Westchester, and apparently Barber told very cynical stories of this visit. The diva arrived with an entourage and a dog, and she was determined that her little dog would have a part in this opera, that she would carry the dog on or something. But ultimately Callas turned it down, and for a very interesting reason.
I have to say, that household needed a dog.
Oh, it did, yeah, many dogs. There were clearly horses. But dogs. But Callas turned the role down because she felt that the main character of interest in the opera was Erica. And I think having been through the story, you get a sense of, yes, she may have started out as the niece and the shadow, but she is the one with true feeling and the one who truly suffers in this piece. She becomes the central character. And in fact, after they had a difficult time, first of all, there was Callas who turned it down, another singer who bailed 6 weeks before opening night. And the final singer, Elena Stäbe, was magnificent, apparently. Erica was Rosalind Alonso, a young singer at the time, who pointed out to Samuel Barber, she said, I love singing this role, but there is no aria for Erica. What about that? And he said, oh, well, I'll put one in. So he wrote Must the Winter Come So Soon, that great, beautiful aria of Erica's. It had not been, had not been part of the original score, and that was included. But so finally it premiered in 1958 at the Met, which was, 20 years after he had written the Adagio for Strings. But things by then were very difficult between him and Samuel Barber and Menotti. I think Barber suffered a lot. I suppose you could say that he was the Erica of the story. That's where he identified with the character who wanted true love, long-lasting love. And Minotti, who was more like Anatole, who was out there and having lots of relationships, much more interested in the short term than the long term. And I think this is woven in, even though at this time the relationship was up and down. Minotti was murdered to work with, apparently. He got the first act written and then took a year off to write The Saint of Bleecker Street, his own opera. And as Barbara wrote, he said he just left Anatole standing out in the cold, got him as far as the entrance into the house, and then nothing happened. So it was a bit tempestuous, but a lot of their own personal tender and difficult life is woven into these characters. That's something that's really interesting to look at now that we can, now that the fact that this was a gay couple and it's okay, it can be explored and we can learn a lot more. But I think the parallels are there between the characters in the opera and the two men.
And I think it's so hard to really know other people's lives.
Of course.
I mean, you can say that, you know, Barbara was the faithful one and Menotti was the player, and yet their love, their friendship was lifelong.
It was.
And their mm-hmm. commitment to each other was lifelong. So there's a lot more going on there than you can define really
well,
sexually.
Well, even in those opening words, you know, love is never what it seems to be. And they say within any great relationship, either partner has not quite the same sense of what it is truly about that the other one does. It's that's one of life's big challenges, dilemmas, joys, and pains, I suppose. Where do we come to love? How do we believe? How is it going to be in the future? It changes all the time. And here, a lot of that, the sadness is expressed. The sadness of love is always sad, it seems, at some point. So it's in the opera. We should talk maybe about the singers. We're going to have the great Aaron Wall, who has sung many roles here, sings Vanessa. Virginie Verez will be Erica, Zach Boruchesky, Anatole, and as I mentioned, James Morris, the great Wagnerian, is singing the cameo role of the Doctor. It's actually a very sweet role, the man who loves this family as his own and has to say farewell, and Leonard Slatkin conducts.
Leonard Slatkin conducts?
Yes, he does.
That's a big deal.
Yes, it is a big deal. He's conductor. He conducted one of the CD records. He conducted the one that I've been playing, actually, is Leonard Slatkin on the Chandos recording. That's a fun one to own if you want to hear more of this opera. When you hear a new opera, if you're not familiar with it the first time, it's hard to get a handle on it because you're not really sure what you're hearing. And this one does bear listening to more than once. Maybe go more than once. That's one way of dealing with it. Or get the CD ahead of time and play it, and you'll get the sense of what it's about. So when you're there, it will be a richer experience.
One of the things that we haven't talked about during our opera series, which isn't quite so relevant, I think, to Vanessa, but maybe to some of the other operas, is the fact that there is a thriving apprentice program at the Santa Fe Opera, and that when there are ensemble scenes, you know, townspeople and so on, those are always played by the apprentices,
yes.
Many of whom then go on to be amazing singers in their own right and come back to sing at the Santa Fe Opera.
In star roles.
In star roles and sing all over the world. And occasionally they are sometimes they're understudies for the singers, and that singer gets sick and they have their premiere at the Santa Fe Opera singing a lead part.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And this is not an easy program to get into. Maybe the production people maybe audition up to 1,000 singers for something like 35 slots. I don't know what the number is this year, but it's not many. And these are young singers who are not just in school. They've all been out. They've sung, many of them, leading roles. But they come to the program here for the incredible experience of working on stage with great singers, with directors and conductors. And there are two evenings in the course of the season, two Sundays, where we have the apprentice concerts. This is where the directors, conductors from the main stage productions, along with costumes and sets, the whole thing, set up opera scenes with the apprentices. That is an incredible opportunity for them. It's a time when general managers come in from other opera houses all over America looking for new talent and pick them up, as they say, and many of them, many, many come back, are invited back as soloists or even in leading roles. That's happened many times. And sometimes they get so good that we lose them altogether. They only sing at the great opera houses and they book 3 or 4 years in advance and we can't get them anymore. But they love being here. You know, this is a family. I mean, I've seen so many situations where the apprentices come as strangers to one another and they are bonding in extraordinary ways, falling in love, falling out of love. And then the whole thing comes to an end at the end. This is something sort of rare now. Theatre used to be like this. You'd be together for the run of a show and you become a very intimate and close family because of what you're doing together, the shared of the love, the art form, singing, whatever it is. And then it all comes to an end. The final night is the final night and you're all gone to the four corners of the earth. That happens here and it's sad. The party on the last night has a sort of bittersweetness to it. But they meet up again. You know, they cross one another's paths all over the place. But if they're part of the apprentice family here in Santa Fe and that's on their resume, it opens all sorts of doors for these young singers.
Well, Desiree Mays, as always, it's a great pleasure doing this series with you every year.
It's always fun.
Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for giving us all this time, Mary Charlotte.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org. And the phone number is 800-280-4654. The local number in Santa Fe is 505-986-5900. Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.